Perhaps a major characteristic of men is the fact that he uses and makes tools. He can augment and increase the strength and the scope of his own biological equipment by the use of tools. He can increase his strength by using a hammer, a lever, a nuclear force. He can increase the scope of his mastery by augmenting the locomotion of his feet, by using a wheel, a car, a space capsule. Through tools, he increases his strength and the scope of his mastery. Ideas also are tools. They are tools used by man to increase his strength and his mastery. Perhaps the greatest utility of ideas is the fact that ideas can be used to give direction and force to human activity, to unify the group, to give it a direction, to give it a purpose, to give it a powerful impetus for movement. Through ideas, men consolidate themselves into forces directed in a single direction. Ideas become the cutting edge of history, the tools that man used to carve his own destiny. We can think of many such cutting edges. Remember that opening phrase of the Basel program, penned by Herzl, a modest statement. The aim of Zionism is to create for the Jewish people a publicly recognized and a legally assured home in Palestine. And through this modest phrase, 2 years later, he appended that blazing apostrophe, "If you will it, it is not a myth." A profound cutting edge into history. Or, we hold these truths to be self-evident from our Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. A powerful cutting edge human history. Or, from a manifesto penned by Karl Marx in 1847, the Communist Manifesto, "Proletarians, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Proletarians, you have a world to conquer. Proletarians of all lands, unite." Ideas are tools. They are weapons. They give a powerful force to human affairs. Used wisely, they lead on to greatness. Used for evil, they lead to man's greatest tragedies. Ideas are weapons. Ideas make of us men. The philosopher Descartes, many centuries ago, when he started opening the windows of our modern world, started out with the assumption that nothing exists but that which he can prove. What was the first fact of existence that he encountered? His classic phrase was, "I think, therefore I am." It was his ideas which convinced him of his existence. His ideas made of him a reality. Or if we wish further proof of the fact that ideas determine the quality of human life, and ideas make men of us, we need only review world history And we find that the forces that are prescribed to our history are the forces of ideas. We think of the development of Jewish history born in the crucible of thought. Or Greek history is the story that they search for truth. What is Roman history but the implementation of the idea of human organization and the possibility of expanding the ordered units of social structure? What is the history of today but the story of two ideas in collision? Ideas make men. And it's inevitable. For man is the kind of a creature who has to define himself. He's not satisfied with his specific moment, with his specific place, but he always feels forced to link himself up with the people about him, with what occurred in the past, and with the destiny that he envisions for himself in the future. Without an idea, he remains alone, isolated, limited with time and place. When a Negro cries out, "We shall overcome," that idea transforms him. It immediately takes this isolated individual whose past has rejected him and whose future holds no possibilities for him. Yet with that idea, he links himself up with mankind. He determines his friends and his enemies. He accepts his past, as tragic as it may be, and he sets out to confront his future. That idea makes of him a man. Perhaps man would be much happier if he didn't have to find purposes for his existence. If he was satisfied with his lot, if he would not endeavor grand adventures which usually backfire, perhaps life would be a calmer, a safer place. But this cannot be life for man. For man must bring himself out to the edges of his destiny. He must seek out his potentiality for greatness and risk the possibilities of tragedy. For man has a tool. He has ideas, and he must use them, but he must choose them carefully and well. We tend to believe that religions have an especial passion for ideas, that they cling to them with a devotion, with an irrationality. This may be true of some religions, certainly not true of all. It's certainly not true of Judaism. Judaism has always been very suspicious about ideas. It's always suspected the man who took an idea and carried it throughout history without alteration, without change. Judaism has a restraint about ideas. If you were to ask Judaism, what is your creed? What are the absolute thoughts that Judaism has affirmed throughout its history? Most people are shocked to find out that Judaism says, "We have no creed. We have no dogmas." And what's most distressing is that Judaism is not ashamed of this fact. Judaism affirms this with pride. "We have no creed. Ideas must not be made divine." There's a classic phrase in the Bible, "No images of God should be made. God cannot be defined. Any definition of him that we make absolute becomes an idol with which we replace God." Ideas can never be made absolute. They are always relative. They must never be canonized. They must be used, but not made part of a creed or a dogma. This is why when the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the organization of Reform Liberal Rabbis of the world, gathered together in 1937 to create a statement of their position. They formulated no creed, no dogma, but a simple statement called the guiding principles of Reform Judaism. Guiding, subject to alteration, linked with the past, very much so, yet leaving themselves open to linkage with the future. And this point of view is perhaps one of the greatest strengths of Judaism. As we look back at the development of our faith, take any of our major ideas, we can see their growth, their alteration through our history. Whether it be the ideas that we use for understanding God, or immortality, or our attitude towards rituals and customs, or to our understanding of the obligations of righteousness, we see a profound evolution occurring throughout time. And we especially find the courage that Judaism has to permit an idea, a noble death. We don't mummify our ideas and drag them through history. We permit them to die, and their time has come. Yet there is one absolute that Judaism insists upon, one test which any idea must pass, the divine test. Does it meet the ethical requirements of God's law? Is the idea in the service of good or evil? If it is in the service of good, the idea is justified. If the idea is in the service of evil, it must be rejected and turned aside. Man's relationship to ideas is extremely important. The way we view our ideas is often as important as the ethical purposes that our ideas are fashioned to perform. Perhaps the most dangerous tendency a man can have in relationship to ideas is to permit his ideas to possess him. Many of us somehow think that great men are the men who are possessed by ideas, who permit their lives to be totally controlled by the force of the thought, and regard their own existence as immaterial in relationship to the dynamic of the idea. And they commit themselves to be used by the idea, carried to the extreme of its own logic. This is a dangerous fallacy. We see this fallacy at work in the South in our present day. The racists of the South have permitted an idea to possess them. And this idea possesses them regardless of its consequences to them. They can't let go of it, or it does not let go of them. So destroying their own possibilities for growth and development, they permit themselves to be driven to the very ends of the logic of their idea. We see another graphic example of possession by an idea in our own past. The story of the witch hunt of Salem and other colonies, so graphically described by Arthur Miller in his book, The Crucible, where our forefathers carried a notion over from Europe with them, the idea that certain kinds of behavior, irrational behavior, can be explained by the notion of possession. The notion that evil spirits, the devil or the Satan, have taken possession of a man, usually a woman. And the way to deal with this possessed person is to destroy this person they call the witch, in case the male, the sorcerer. And this idea possessed them. They increase their standards by which they determine what possession is, and increase the fury which they level at the witches and the sorcerers, not recognizing that they were dealing with mental illness, and that their own fury increased the incidence of witchcraft among their people. They tried to purify their people of the devil, yet by the possession of their idea, they increased witchcraft, they increased sorcery, and destroyed that very integrity they sought to preserve. These two examples deal with evil ideas, ideas which are intrinsically dangerous to man. This concept of possession applies also to good ideas. A man, even though he be possessed by a good idea, is also destroying himself. I think of the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages. It was possessed by a marvelous idea, the idea of social responsibility, the conviction that each man is responsible for the destiny of his brothers. And since, in that time, destiny was understood as a characteristic of the soul, they were concerned with saving the souls of all men. We know to what length the Inquisition was carried, because men were possessed by this one idea, that they knew what salvation means for all men, and that it was their responsibility to use whatever means or forces necessary to fulfill their responsibility to others. They were possessed by an idea. I saw a magnificent presentation of this thought just a few weeks ago in a dramatic presentation at Caramon Theater. It was a powerful play called Defiant Island, written by James Forsythe. It was the story of a slave king of Haiti, a former slave king of Haiti, Henry Christophe. And he was determined that he would raise his people from the past, from the voodoo superstition, from their slave institutions, from their colonial existence, and he would drive his people into their future. He spared no effort. He made no concessions to his own feelings, for he knew that there was only one goal that mattered, bringing his people from the past into the future. Possessed by this idea, he destroys not only himself, but his people as well. As noble as his idea was, it was related only to itself, not to reality, not to the next step on the road to virtue and to goodness. Man must not permit his ideas to possess him. He must possess them. He must be in control of them, using them, understanding their limitations, understanding their power, understanding their danger. What is the greatness of Martin Luther King? He possesses an idea. An idea not of his own creation. The idea of nonviolence. The nonviolent confrontation is not a new idea. It's found in our Constitution, in the first article of our Bill of Rights, freedom to assembly, to demonstrate, to demand redress from grievances. But he possessed this idea and understands its logic and its strength and its power. And he has the capacity to know how far it can go, where it should stop, where it should be patient, where it should cross, where it should retreat. He possesses an idea, and he uses it well. What was the charisma of Pope John the 23rd? He was the first Catholic, in my understanding, the first Catholic Pope who refused to be possessed by the idea of Catholicism and decided that it is time that the Church possessed its idea in turn. This was his gesture when in his study he went to the window and threw open the windows and said, "It's time to let some fresh air into the Church." What he was saying, it's time for us to understand the power of our idea, its strength, also its weakness, also its limitations, to understand its destiny, and also to understand that which is linked to the past and which should not be dragged along with us any further. His greatness was in this mere act of reversal from being possessed. The Church now possesses, and now the Church is one of the mighty forces in our world. It finally possesses its idea. What was the greatness of Rabbi Arthur Hillel Silver? He possessed the idea of Zionism. He knew its meaning, he knew its past, he knew its destiny. He knew its force. He also knew its weakness. He also knew what the idea required, the pressures that had to be brought to bear, the timing, the pacing, the leverage that must be used, the time for going to the street, the time for going to the councils of the international world, the time for patience and for hope, and the time for revision and alteration. He possessed his idea and enabled it to be fulfilled. When man possesses his ideas, he permits himself greatness. Sometimes we possess our ideas, but in a dishonest way. We use ideas to cover parts of ourselves, to express something indirectly. I think of the begrudging man, the selfish man, who wishes to assume no responsibility to those he shares life with. He feels that any kind of invasion upon his sense of responsibility is a threat to his existence. Very frequently, he will cover his own limitation with the thought, America is an individualistic society. Each man must stand for himself. This is the greatness of America. Ours is the free system. Any kind of obligation that one group places upon another or one individual places upon another is un-American. He's really hiding the simple fact that he wishes to assume no responsibility for others, that he begrudges any obligation. Well, very frequently we come across prejudice in its disguised form. People are much too sensitive these days to say that they have any prejudice. Well, there's a very effective way of saying it, and that's through chauvinism, or through excessive faith. My country is the greatest country in the world. What is he saying? I'm better than you. My religion is the noblest faith. Your religion is no good. But the ideal expression covers the limitation. Or the man who wishes to cut other people down to size to prove his own importance. There's a marvelous strategy he can use. He says, I am a man of the highest standard. Which means that his high standards apply to you, but not to him. And using these high standards, everyone gets cut down to size. And since he doesn't apply them to himself, he is the only man who remains standing in full stature. We have a very similar technique in the North that most Northerners use. Northerners have learned from the South that it's dangerous to be outspoken about racism. Point of view. So we learn to talk civil right, but to act civil wrong. We say the right things, the noble things, the liberal ideas. All the while we're living lily white lives, preferably in lily white neighborhoods. Perhaps one or two Negroes are allowed in to take the edge off of our guilt. We talk right, but we act wrong. Many Negroes have come to the conclusion that they prefer to do business with the southern racists. At least they stand up and identify themselves, and they have a chance of victory. In the North, the guerrilla warfare is much too difficult. You can't tell your friends from your enemies. And I suspect unless the northern white man deals honestly with his facts, he will create a situation of tension much more difficult in the North than in the South. For in the North, he effectively frustrates the Negro and gives him no recourse except for irrational behavior. In the South, the Negro can act rationally, as he has done, because he knows what he has to do. In the North, we don't give him the grace of letting him know who his enemies are. If we wish to be enemies, let us define ourselves as such. if we wish to be friends, let us also define ourselves as such. But to use our ideas to cover our feelings is an unfortunate use of ideas, a usage which tends to degrade man and to bring him to the low point in his history. America has a philosophy about ideas. We feel that ideas have their limitations and they have their uses. And it is tremendously important that we have a free marketplace for ideas. A free area where we go to examine our own ideas in relationship to others, perhaps to tailor our own, to permit them to grow, to change them if necessary, to alter them, to permit them to interact with other ideas, and to be more applicable to our time and to our place. We feel it's necessary to have a free market for ideas. The first article of the Bill of Rights expressed this conviction. It said, I recall, Congress shall make no laws concerning the establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, to demand redress from the government for their grievances. This must be a society open to ideas, open to different convictions, open to the various forces which may emerge from within the society. Only in this way can America, at least according to its founding fathers, only in this way can America use its ideal ideas in keeping with its purposes and its goals. As Americans officially, we are very concerned with any kind of interference in the free marketplace of ideas. Unfortunately, presently, there are many interferences in the free flow of information and thought. We can refer very quickly to the commercialization of the media of communication, to the fact that newspapers in many communities are biased, and many communities have only one newspaper. There are many pressures which drive a censorship in our society which limit the free flow of ideas. I wish to think this morning of one area of interference and to share it with you. It's an area of censorship which, in a sense, all of us are influenced by. It's the censorship which our society has been imposing upon itself as a result of our Cold War with the communist world. Increasingly, Americans tend to feel that anything which in the slightest way has any kind of relationship to socialism or to communism is in a sense taboo, un-American, dangerous. And we tend to shy away from these thoughts. I know for many years the civil rights movement was impeded by the fact that whenever a Negro or a white or a wife would take an outspoken position about racism in America, he was immediately identified as a pink, or as a red, or as a radical, or as one of those two dangerous liberals. The same was true of the poverty program. Whenever anyone expressed any excessive concern about the fact that in our most wealthy land they are poor people, he was regarded as a spokesman for the proletariat, as a pink. It prevented us from facing a problem. I had a very dramatic experience of this sort some years ago. I was teaching the section of the Bible which had to do with the sabbatical year, the Shemitah year. Every seventh year in ancient Israel, the land was supposed to lie fallow. And this was also the period when slaves were freed, and also when debt of the poor, which could not be paid until the seventh year, was permitted to be forgotten. And one student stood up and said, this is socialistic propaganda. This is communism. You have no right to say that the Bible teaches such things, or if the Bible teaches such things, it should not be used. Of course, the fact of the Bible preceded Karl Marx by a handful score of years is relatively immaterial. But he was convinced that the Bible was socialistic. But he was demonstrating a danger. And this is the fact that if we oppose communism intelligently, we have to differentiate between communism and communism. Karl Marx took some of the worst ideas of Western society. At the same time, he took some of the best ideas of Western society. He took some of the most immoral Machiavellian schemes presently in existence, but he wedded them with some of the noblest goals of the Jewish and Christian and Western culture. He wedded the idea of the social responsibility of people for each other with the immoral conviction that it makes no difference how one asserts one's responsibilities, that the end justifies the means. If we throw off the baby with the bath, we'll be throwing off the best of our own culture and our own society. When we oppose communism, we must understand what we oppose. And when we condemn as socialistic any urge for social responsibility on our own part, we are deceiving ourselves in advance of any communist onslaught. Now this applies to political affairs as well. I find myself very much in agreement with Rabbi Dan concerning the matter of South Vietnam. But I find that my concern, in addition to his, is motivated by some experiences which I have had in a similar situation in Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, where my wife and I spent 2 years from 1952 to 1954. Let me tell you why I compare these two things. In South Vietnam, we have really two problems. The first problem is the fact that we're dealing with an internal revolution in a country, South Vietnam, a group of rebels called the Viet Cong. Now, interestingly, I could read very little why these people are in rebellion. All I know from the press is the fact that there is aggression from the north, that North Vietnam is infiltrating and causing a rebellion to occur in South Vietnam. And I wonder, what started the thought to begin with? My experiences in the Philippines in 52, when we came there, we were told that there was a large uprising of the Hoc Van Lahat, the fighters for liberation. And the Hoc were called communist dissidents under the control of Red Steiner to a large degree. They had been infiltrated into the Hoc areas and were largely controlling and manning these dissident groups. When we came to the Philippines, we found that there was a large group of orphan children living in the area outside of the base, Clark Air Force Base, where we were living. And we established a program called Operation Brotherhood, which would care for these orphan children. Many of them were the children of slain Hoc fighters. We also included many children of non-Hoc, of local people who were killed as a result of the struggle. We had an opportunity to find out quite a bit about the background of the children who were supposedly Hooked. And we found out that they were not communists. The words meant literally nothing to their parents or to their surviving parents. That these were landless peasant families, that their struggle was caused by their lack of food, and by the fact that they were subjected to a sharecropper economy which permitted them no dignity and no freedom of death. They rose in rebellion simply to express their need for land. From 45 to 52, they were treated as communists. They were attacked by the military, driven into the hills, and their power grew and increased. Until by the year 52, there was serious danger that the entire Republic of the Philippines would be dominated by these dissidents. By 1952, a man, Ramon Magsaysay, became very important to the affairs of state of the Philippine Islands. He was a man profoundly pro-American, profoundly democratic, yet realistic. He realized that he was not involved in a struggle between Red China and America, that this was not an ideological conflict that confronted him, that these were not communists fighting America, but rather these were landless people rebelling against the system which drove them from the land 400 years ago when the Spanish conqueror came to the Philippines, and they were simply demanding their right to land. And he did something very simple. He said, if you surrender, I will forgive you. We have lots of unused land in the southern islands. We will enable you to possess this land, and we will help you get settled. By the year 1957, the year he tragically died, the hook for the hop revolution had literally disappeared. But since 1957, new forces came into power. They forgot the promises made by Ramon Magsaysay. And presently, in the year 1965, the hook for the hop is once again an important feature of the Philippine countryside. And just last week, I read a newspaper story which disturbed me immensely. And this was a request by the Philippine Islands that the Americans establish a base on the southern tip of the southern islands of the Philippines to prevent Indonesia from fomenting peasant unrest in the Philippine Islands. And the Philippines were concerned that through Indonesia, the communist world would come in and start trouble. That trouble was there for a long time. They know what to do about it in a democratic way. If they fail to do it and say that whatever occurs in the Philippines is as a result of the conflict between communist world and the democratic world, this will be a distortion of the facts. There's a real problem. It can be faced. It should not be hidden by an ideological conflict. I'm concerned about South Vietnam. I wonder why the Viet Cong are fighting. I really don't know why. But I suspect that there may be another set of answers unrelated to world conflict which can be used. And if it's too late for that in South Vietnam, I suspect there are many other portions of the globe faced with similar circumstances where it's not too late for us to act. The marketplace of our ideas is being remarkably constricted by our feelings concerning the Cold War. We are hurting ourselves by limiting our freedom of thought and the process of our selection of ideas. Ideas, my friends, have a compelling quality. If they meet the test of goodness, the requirements of truth, and guide us to the next step of the road to benevolence and virtue, they don't possess us, but we feel compelled to possess them. There are many such ideas current in our present world. We shall overcome as one of them. The war against poverty, disease, and ignorance is another one. The idea of one world united through a set of laws which can reach decisions concerning conflicts peaceably is a powerful idea which increasingly will be getting hold of us. Man can be moved by those ideas which point out his destiny and his history. And there was one powerful idea which, to my mind, seems to include all of these tools of the mind. and as time strikes off from it. It's an idea drawn from our own Jewish tradition, expressed most powerfully by the prophet Micah. In the end of days, he predicted, many people shall go and say, let's go up to the house of the Lord. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his path. And his laws shall decide between many nations, and shall judge between mighty nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. For they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. Ideas are weapons. If we permit them to possess us, if we use them unworthily, they lead to our downfall. If we possess them and use them to guide us the next step towards benevolence and virtue, they become the cutting edge of man's greatness. They help us carve our destiny.